Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the PCJ Radio International Newsroom. Marshall Islanders have exploded back into life on the internet after a virtual blackout of more than 3 weeks. Internet access had severely limited while repairs were being carried out on the country's submarine cable. Marshall Islands correspondent Gib Johnson told Joe O'Brien about the response and when it was switched on again.
After 23 days with basically very little access to internet, cable repairs were completed. It was turned back on, and the explosion of Marshall Islanders appearing on Facebook was evidence that the internet is back on and live for most people in the Marshall Islands.
So has it been a bit of a hardship for people having that lack of internet connection?
The biggest problem has been for businesses because they went to satellites in the meantime while the cable was being repaired, and that put us down to about 3% of the normal bandwidth. So we just... there was nothing. So internet time was rationed. Businesses or government offices got it on a as-needed basis for maybe two-hour slots or three-hour slots, and then you were off. And email generally was accessible, but couldn't get on the web, couldn't go to websites, and this affected ordering, vendors, payments. There were a lot of issues early on. But then the telecom bought some extra satellite bandwidth, and that helped to get more people on. And at least email was then accessible. I mean, of course, you've got people who are used to being on Facebook and communicating that way, or Netflix and YouTube and all of these streaming sites. And those were just turned off, essentially, during this cable downtime because there was no bandwidth for people to access them.
And do we know how the cable, the submarine cable, was damaged? And if this repair job is permanent, there's not going to be any more problems?
I don't have details on that. There really has been no detailed information offered about it. They said it's done. This was the first time there was a repair needed on the cable since it was installed in 2009.
So it's been pretty reliable up until this point.
And I don't know that there was any impact on telecommunications services before they did the repair, but technicians had identified what they called a power anomaly within the cable near Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands and decided that they needed to be proactive and repair it rather than let it sit. And then while they were doing the repairs, there was a second repair that ended up happening, which was to the armor around the cable on the ocean side at Kwajalein, right off the atoll. So that was a second thing that went on, and presumably is part of the reason that the completion was delayed a bit beyond what it was initially thought.
There are warnings that a majority of security forces called out to Papua New Guinea's Hela province will not provide a long-term solution to the ongoing tribal fighting. Last month, 300 police and military personnel were deployed to Hela, which is the home of the lucrative LNG project, after months of tribal fighting and a buildup of high-powered arms. Dozens of people are understood to have died last year in fighting and lawlessness, which has been participated badly around the capital of Hela, Tari. Johnny Blades has more.
Since the call-out, police have been on a province-wide drive to collect illegal firearms in Hela. There's an amnesty in place for tribes to surrender their guns by the end of February. The deputy governor of Hela, Thomas Potabe, says that since the call-out, fighting has cooled off.
I don't think they will fight more. Last 2 weeks ago, they are stopping it fighting, and now province is quiet, and we have almost 300 police and armies on the ground. So I don't think we will get a big fighting like before we did.
However, there's scepticism from NGO worker James Komengi, who worked with the successful Young Ambassadors for Peace program, facilitating mediation between warring tribes since 2008. He says merely taking some guns out of the equation would not help in the long term, because tribal fighting is entrenched in Hela, the result of a lack of public services and development, and because warlords would seek more weapons if they felt exposed.
We are giving a holiday to the warlords, and it looks like it's only a call out for the arms, and they don't have any programs that will be left behind to help us transform the communities. And that's something I think the politicians will seriously have to get into to transform the province. Otherwise, it's more like a temporary break for the warlords.
For others, it's a question of leadership. A Hela community leader, George Tagobe, says local police had the resources to deal with the fighting before a call-out was needed, but that direction was lacking.
Our leaders, when they are in there, when they show the presence in, where the fighting area is, people respect. When there's no leaders, they run around like animals. Now, the local police, they can be able to perform, but they're waiting for orders to come. They can't just go in and conduct raids and go into the fighting zone without any orders from the hierarchies.
The police operations commander, David Manning, says Hela people have lost confidence in the region's governance, and that needs to be restored in order to end lawlessness.
Over the years, the thinking of the people of Hela is that the national government has abandoned them, has really not given much focus on addressing some of the socio-economic challenges that the people face up here. And as such, there was a building resentment towards the government, both national, provincial and district level.
He says ending fighting is a huge task and won't be finished quickly.
The success of this operation hangs all over the shoulders of the people of Hela, and how we, the operations, can engage in effective and productive partnerships with them in resolving the future of the province.
Provincial government officials, meanwhile, say the call-out has sparked peace talks between warring tribes, and they are hopeful of a lasting settlement. This is Johnny Blades.
Police officers in Papua New Guinea are rumored to be protecting a colleague who's alleged to have murdered his wife. Pachula Waga was paralyzed after a brutal beating last year and died at Port Moresby 2 weeks ago. The 25-year-old is survived by her 4-year-old son. Last year, a policeman was sentenced to 20 years in prison for murdering his wife, but Ms. Wanga's husband has yet to be arrested. Ben Robinson-Drawbridge reports.
The police won't comment on their investigation into Priscilla Wonga's husband or on suggestions he's being shielded from justice by colleagues in the police force. The National Program Coordinator for the Family Sexual Violence Action Committee, Ume Wainete, says typically police look after their friends.
That always happens because many are also perpetrators themselves, so they try to protect their own. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is because of the police commissioner's stand on this issue, many of these police officers have been dealt with. Some have lost jobs, others have been jailed.
Ms. Wainete says it's common for the wives of police officers to suffer from domestic violence.
So there are many police officers who are beating their wives. Like one I met showed me a photograph of herself before she started getting beaten up. And she was one of the ugliest women in this country I met. Her bone structures all changed. But she still begged me not to report him to the department because he might lose his job because he was the breadwinner.
Domestic violence was made an offence in 2013, 3 years after the United Nations cited data that two-thirds of women in PNG had been beaten by their husbands. A hotline to report abuse was set up in 2015, but the president of the PNG Counsellors Association, Susan Setai, says it's difficult to get survivors to come forward.
Women are just too scared to go to. They cannot report any cases to police because police will always tell them that it's your personal issue and it's a family matter, domestic issue, so you go back and sort it out with your husband.
Efforts by the police to crack down on staff abusing their partners has been complemented by the establishment of family sexual violence units in some police stations. The manager of Oxfam's Gender Justice Program in the Highlands, Sarah Chapeau, says to counter domestic violence, her NGO partners with local organisations who report good relations with police.
The Family Sexual Violence Unit is the section of the police that our partners do communicate with and have been involving them in trainings, in workshops. They are part of the rapid response team in the Highlands, where they go into villages to help our partners take out survivors of socially related violence and, of course, aggravated violence. So it's a good sign of seeing how police are becoming responsive.
Sarah Chapeau says following the collapse of several mismanaged women's refuges, Oxfam is now focused on the prevention of gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea. This has been Robinson Drawbridge.
Mosquitoes carrying Zika and dengue will become easier for health officials to identify with the publication of a new key. The spread of mosquito-borne diseases such as Zika and dengue, which is a problem across the Pacific, with a number of cases on the rise. New Zealander Tom Swan completed his Master's in Biology Sciences at University of Canterbury and recently returned from a Fulbright scholarship trip to the United States to research mosquitoes. He told Daniela Morote Cox he was inspired to create the identifying key while in Florida and hopes it'll help Pacific governments reduce mosquito larvae breeding sites.
Mosquito larvae have what's called comb scales, which is small hair-like features on the anterior aspect of the body, right down the bottom of the body, which you can use to as an identification tool. And by drawing these, it was a lot easier to visualize for not only the scientists looking at it, the mosquito larvae under the microscope, but also for the key itself. So more of a visualization tool.
I would have thought that all mosquitoes are bad, and I would try to eradicate all of them. So are some worse than others?
Yeah, so there's over 3,600 mosquito species globally, and not all mosquitoes are treated equally. So some mosquitoes don't even bite people. Others do bite people, and those are the more famous, notorious mosquitoes that we've been hearing about in the news with respect to recently Zika virus in South America and also expanding throughout the Pacific and also into North America. Mosquitoes that have been spreading that are called Aedes aegypti, which is what was traditionally known as the yellow fever mosquito, and Aedes albopictus, which is known as the Asian tiger mosquito. So those two mosquitoes are notorious for being able to spread Zika, dengue, chikungunya viruses.
And those diseases are becoming a major problem in many of the countries in the Pacific. So will this key help people identify the larvae that those mosquitoes come from?
Yes, that is correct. So also during my master's, I did this in Tonga. I did a survey of Tongatapu Island Group, quite an extensive survey over a period of a month where I collected mosquito larvae all throughout the main island in artificial habitats, including bucket tyres, plastic containers, which surprisingly, mosquito larvae were most commonly found in, but also in pools and ponds all throughout the island, which mosquito larvae were also found in. And both Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, we found, occur a widespread distribution throughout the main island, which is worryingly because they have had reportedly outbreaks of dengue and chikungunya and now Zika virus in the last few years within Tonga, and also other countries throughout the South Pacific.
So having this key published is going to be really helpful. Who's going to be able to use it? Who can access this?
Well, I think it will be really helpful to aid entomologists and people that work at the Ministry of Health and able to identify these important vectors of disease, the larvae that is. Who's going to be able to access it? Well, it's published within the New Zealand Entomologist. So people with having a subscription to that journal can access it.
I guess the general public wouldn't really be able to identify mosquito larvae. They know the bug once it bites you, especially.
Yeah, so interestingly, when I was in Tonga, which was rather disconcerting, a lot of people didn't realise that the mosquito larvae, which is called Ika Ika Awai in Tongan, evolved and metamorphosed into the adult, the Namu mosquito, the Namu being mosquito in Tongan, and that the Namu was what bit you and was capable of spreading diseases. So that was a part of my time there, was actually spent educating individuals about this occurrence.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The creators of a floating community planned for French Polynesia hope the project will eventually lead to hundreds of new islands for people at risk from rising seas. French Polynesia signed a deal with the U.S.-based Sea Steady Institute to collaborate on a pilot project earlier this month. The Institute's executive director, Randolph Henken, says the eventual plan is for thousands of floating cities on the ocean. But he told Sally Round the pilot will involve just a few dozen people on platforms in the Tahiti Lagoon.
Our plans are to float on the water, to use non-fossil fuels for our energies. We can collect wind, wave, and solar power. There's a lot of energy in those waves. And what we're trying to do with our first project down there in Tahiti is to prove this technology. This is a pilot project to prove our hypothesis. The exact location and site haven't been determined yet, but we hope to be in a lagoon in Tahiti. That means we can build our floating islands on the inside of a reef break and be protected from the open ocean. Makes it easier to engineer. And, you know, we have a lot of great designs on our website. If people go to seasteading.org, they can see them, but they should take it with a grain of salt. Those are all artist renditions, and now the rubber's hitting the road, so to speak, and it's time for us to come up with a real design that we actually plan to implement there.
I understand that French Polynesia approached you. What's in it for them?
Yeah, that's correct. A Tahitian named Mark Collins, who was the former Minister of Tourism and is an entrepreneur businessman now, they read about us in a magazine and reached out to us last May. We went down in September, toured and presented a proposal, and then started working together on this memorandum of understanding. This is a mutual cooperation. French Polynesia is looking for a resiliency plan for rising sea levels, and they're looking for economic activity to keep their population engaged. You know, the biggest economic driver is tourism, and we want to bring in technologists and other research opportunities so that the young people can be involved in modernity. This would be direct and indirect investment for them. If we are bringing a new technology, a new industry down there, we think that there'll be a lot of opportunities, both directly on the floating platforms, the floating islands, as well as helping to service them and all the indirect benefits of us going to their restaurants and stores. And
there might be some opposition to this. What are the big fears that you've seen people expressing, and how are you addressing those?
Sure. Well, and what we've seen is that it's reasonable for people to be weary of something they don't know, if they haven't heard about or seems new, maybe particularly if the first time they hear about it is from their government and they think that they're going to have to use their own tax dollars to subsidize some foreigner's wild idea. But when we explain to the locals that we're not asking for their tax subsidies, that we're going to fund this project through our own investments that we raise outside of French Polynesia or outside of the government, that assuages a lot of their fears. Unfortunately for us, we've been ghettoized by media who likes to repeat a story that we are a bunch of rich people trying to escape and go create a utopia, which doesn't characterize any of the people I work with, who are all novel thinkers and go-getters and who are excited about the opportunity to do something good for humanity. What excites me the most about this project is the technology that we're going to have to use to build floating islands is interesting, but it's really about the people. This won't be a successful project if we don't have a good community. That's based on people who are choosing to come live here because they want to be a pioneer on the blue frontier with us.
How do you envisage the whole city being run? I mean, is this, in the French Polynesia case, going to be part of French Polynesia, or is it its own separate entity with its own laws, its own flag, that sort of thing?
We are certainly part of French Polynesia. That's just the way sovereignty works when we're in their territorial waters. Our collaboration with them does hinge upon them creating a special governing framework opportunity for us so that we can self-administer our sea zone. But I would not anticipate it to be as radical as some might imagine. I think that, it's going to be a chance for us to try things differently.
But ultimately, the idea would be to have separate city-states at sea?
Well, this pilot project is a pilot project. It's a chance to do the proof of concept It's going to start with just a few platforms. You know, we're going to learn a lot about the technology when we have several dozen people, you know, living on these floating islands and coming through and checking them out. Over time, we hope, you know, with success, we will grow. Eventually, we'll outgrow the lagoon and we'll need to move elsewhere. At the same time, we hope that our industry becomes, you know, successful and we're able to send these floating islands to the, you know, millions of people who are at risk of, you know, losing their home to rising seas. And we have a long-term vision of, you know, 1,000 cities out on the open ocean, you know, experimenting with its own way of conducting society.
New legislation aimed at turning Palau into a luxurious destination is to be put before the new Congress, which came into power on Friday. The proposed law will restrict future investments to five-star hotel chains. The legislation is part of President Tommy Ramagasu's vision to reduce tourism numbers and increase tourist spending. It comes after a huge influx of tourists in 2015 and 2016, thanks mostly to the increase of package tours from mainland China. That growth, however, has come at a cost, with the overcrowding having some negative environmental and social impacts. He told Corey Hawkins, focusing on high-end tourism is aimed at limiting that impact.
So our vision for the next 4 years is really to implement our vision of a pristine paradise, Palau. This is in line with our desire to make Palau a high-end destination. So our focus will be on quality as tourism, quality investments, as opposed to just increasing the number of tourists coming to Palau.
And I note you're proposing legislation, or you'll be working on legislation this year that will make it, you will only approve future development for five-star hotel development, or what's the intention there?
That's right. We will, for major foreign investment applications to Palau, we, especially in the hotel industry, we will only entertain five-star or high-end investments.
And you're providing some incentives, I understand. There's some conditions that you're looking
yes,
at.
Yes, the incentives would be that, and our definition of high-end would be that they would also come in with their own designed water treatment system, power backups, water system backups. If there are any other infrastructures that they have to do, like repairing roads, or they would do it, the investor would do it themselves. In return for that, we will give them the necessary tax break and exemption for them.
Finally, a timeline on your proposed legislation.
The legislation was actually submitted with this last Congress, but it does, time now doesn't look like they're going to be able to finish the job. So we'll take it up on the with the next Congress, but the incoming Congress leadership and myself have talked about it, and it will be done in the first 100 days.
Feasts at weddings, birthdays, funerals could be providing the perfect encouragement for Pacific people to overindulge in sugary drinks. Excessive consumption of sugar can lead to obesity, weight gain, type 2 diabetes, gout, and even tooth decay. University of Auckland master's student Paul Nye is researching the cultural factors that can drive the consumption of sugar sweetening beverages, or SSBs, in New Zealand. He told Daniela Moradi-Cox, Pacific Islanders are the highest consumers of sugary drinks in New Zealand, and accessibility may be playing a part.
A lot of my family members are obese and have diabetes and other health issues. This was always a concern for me. So I took the topic and I did some research on it, and I found that the Pacific Islanders are the highest consumers of sugar sweetened beverages in New Zealand. And I also found that they are the most likely to consume it, and this is despite them being a minority in New Zealand.
It's interesting that you're coming at it from a marketing perspective.
Most people
would assume that this would come under health.
The reason why we're taking a marketing perspective on it, because it's a consumption behavior. Marketing and advertising and whatever, everything that comes in these marketing does play a role in the consumption of SSBs by the Pacific Islanders. But really, the research looks at a different factor, like one that might be playing a bigger role, and that's the Pacific culture.
So you're talking about a lot of special occasions where people will be drinking and eating, where sugary drinks might be available. I mean, how many special occasions could you be attending in a year? What are the kind of events you'd be going to?
So any events, it could be a wedding, it could be a birthday, and even at funerals, they come with big feasts, and it's expected that there will be a feast there. So that is likely to contain sugary drinks as the dominant beverage for those practices and those feasts.
So you must have been to a lot of events yourself where you would have seen a couple of bottles there. How many are we talking here? Is it bulk?
Yeah, so that's the thing. Our Pacific people are more likely to consume it, not because they're buying it, but because feast givers are buying it in bulk, so that allows for more people to consume it. And you see it, like a general layout on the table, you'll have three big bottles of juice there, and then you also have other fizzy drinks there. So it's very excessive in terms of what is provided. So there is a lot of it, more than what is necessary for pretty much human consumption. So there's just too much of it available to our people.
When it comes down to it, the negative consequences of this can be quite severe. What are some of the health implications that you know of?
Yeah, so biggest contributors of the sugary drinks is to obesity. You've also got things like weight gain, type 2 diabetes, gout, and you've also got tooth decay. A lot of the youth are getting their teeth pulled out. That's all from sweet products, but mostly from sugary drinks.
And it's important to note here that you're not blaming those special occasions as the cause of this problem.
Yeah,
you're just saying that there's been a bit of an influence along the line where the drinks that have been on offer have changed and they've become unhealthy.
Yeah, of course. So we've got to be careful with like how we do the research. We don't want to offend anyone. Really, it's about providing an understanding for why this might be happening and moving towards providing ways of how to prevent it and be more healthy.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perrault, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.